Well, good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to Speaking in Tongues. Today we have an extra special treat. A couple of friends from my part of the world, from Grass Valley, have just published a book, a Bear River Books, Queen of the Northern Mines, a novel of the Civil War in California. I'd like to welcome Richard Hurley and T.J. Meekins. Queen of the Northern Mines, also a sobriquet for Nevada City,
right. The
Queen City of the Northern Mines.
I was motioning for Richard to get up on the microphone, but I'll take it first.
Okay.
Nevada City has been a center of culture and wealth.
Oh,
and
yeah. It was the third largest city in California there for a while. We were riding high.
Well, and if you go around downtown, you'll see New England Victorian architecture, the like of which you won't see in a lot of places west of, the Alleghenies, you know.
If you go out of town, most of it burned, of course, several times over.
A couple of times in your book.
Yeah.
Well, that was a historical fire, though. That actually happened when we said it did.
Well, that's what's the fun here. And I always try to avoid too much book chat, although it's got this great John Everett and Millay painting on the front that's on KDBS.org with the show page today.
Sophie Gray, she was the niece of Millay.
Yeah, I think it was a family, and he did a spectacular job on her. She's a psychological portrait that is so far advanced for the time that the people in the gallery keep getting questions. Is she really in the 19th
She's
century?
Still around.
You know? Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about the book. Tell us, we'll get into the history in a minute, but I know you don't want to give away the story, but nonetheless, tell us about the story of the book, and then we'll talk about the history of the book.
It's a little hard to characterize. You could call it a coming-of-age story for a young Victorian woman who lives on the frontier, or you could call it a Western adventure story because you've got robbers running around and Confederate partisans, and there's a lot of lead flying. But to us, I think the real interest was the fact that Nevada City was built in 10 years to become a cultural hub for people from all over the globe. And that was irresistible. You know, never before in human history had you had so much wanton greed unleashed in such a short time. And you had the steamship, which meant that all those very adventurous young people, tending to be men on a ratio of about 12 to 1, showed up. And they didn't quite know what to do with each other when they all ended up working side by side. There was a certain amount of friction, which is always good for novels. And particularly between the Northerners and Southerners at that time, the United States was heading for the massive train wreck we now call the Civil War.
That's the most interesting thing because I think, you know, we look at history of the pre-war era and we see the Missouri Compromise, the Compromise of 1850 and the Gadsden Purchase and all the, Mexican wars and all of that. And all of a sudden, California gets admitted as a free state, and it's like who tricked the slave power?
Oh well, the slave power backed away at the last minute.
Exactly,
because they were out here in force. The Southerners went down to Monterey just like everybody else to figure out what California ought to be and make up a constitution, largely because Washington was refusing to do it. Washington, oddly enough, was in complete gridlock at the time.
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't get anything through. That was acceptable to both North and South. Calhoun had gotten up on the Senate floor. He actually had someone read it for him. He was too sick to read himself.
I was going to say his very last effort was sitting while somebody else read his speech.
Yes, and he was saying, you know, if you dare to admit California's a free state, we're out of here and we're going to, you know, throw some lead at you as quick as ever we can if you try to bring us back. And this was a little different from what the Southerners out here felt. They were busy mining, and the ethos out here was one man, one claim. You brought out your pick and your shovel, and you didn't come as a big group. And the last thing anybody wanted to see was slavery out here, because there's a lot of brutal labor involved in mining, and you didn't really want to compete with people who didn't have to be paid.
Exactly. You really have the rest of the country in a different economic stage from particularly California and the gold country, which was the whole driving motor of the move towards statehood. They might have waited a while if they hadn't had the gold rush.
I think California, just before the gold rush, was legitimately considered the remotest place on earth. And you know, the Mexican government, for instance, had no particular say over the rancheros, who were the people mm-hmm. who ran the place before the Americans decided it was American territory.
You know, the when it comes to land stealing and enslaving folks and everything else, it just goes all the way back to the beginning. I remember, you know, decline of the Californios tracking that whole sort of, you've got these big land grants, but you can't really tell what the boundaries are because they're just big land grants. So people come whizzing in and say, well, I got a deed to this part of it here, and it ain't yours no more.
No, there was a lot of misbehavior.
By the time the 1860s are starting to creep up upon us in the latter part of the 50s, the Californios were getting very disaffected mm-hmm. with the national government because they weren't confirming their land grants. There was, mm-hmm. you know, considerable disaffection, and they were lining up with the South. Pico Act was passed in 1859 to split California, split off the southern six counties and make it into a slaveholding state that would enjoy mm-hmm. cordial relations with the South. Oh, a territory first, right? The territory of Colorado.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then bring it on, I suppose, admit it later with...
Yeah, most people don't know that that actually passed the legislature in Sacramento, and it was in Washington for consideration. It kind of got bumped off the agenda by Fort Sumter. But if you didn't have the outbreak of the war at that point, you probably would have had two Californias.
Mm-hmm.
Because the southern politicians were generally much better than the northern politicians and tended to get a lot of compensation for the slight to slavery, you know, and one of which would have been another slave state in California.
Well, I knew a Calhoun 40 years ago who insisted that his family should have been compensated for all those bondmen that were taken from them by the occupation government.
The heartless Yankees.
Ooh, I'll tell you, it was, it's still out there. But, yeah. I think the thing to me you keep coming back to is the slave power was so much more powerful. I mean, if you go back to many junctures in the history of the country, the way votes get counted for president, starting in one of the very first elections, just everything has to accommodate slave owners, you know, not just the Constitution, but every little bit of decision.
Well, the Constitution sure helped there by giving you a whole lot of extra votes for all the people you owned.
Mm-hmm.
And that rankled in the North. That was hard to accept. So, yeah, they felt like they were fighting uphill, that the Constitution had already kind of rigged the game against Northern interests. But the demographics were solidly behind the North by the middle of the 19th century, and the southern politicians were increasingly aware of that and nervous, and that's why they bolted when Lincoln got into office.
Well, it's by 1840, it was clear that the things were not going to last, and to get another 20 years out of it was pretty remarkable all by itself, because at that point the two regions just diverged so radically.
It's fascinating to think if the war hadn't come, and Lincoln was quite sincere in saying that he didn't want to mess with mm-hmm. Slavery in the South. And the Republican Party in general was perfectly willing to let the South go for as long as they felt like it. It was the territories, finally, that created the friction that burst into flame.
Exactly. No, that's really it, because fine, they've got their people, they've got their stuff, we've got, what we've got, and they would have left them behind in the dust anyway.
It's fascinating to think how long the southern economic system would have gone on. I honestly think it would have made it around the turn of the century.
Mm-hmm.
I think finally mass transportation and communications would bring it down. It's hard to keep people in bondage if you have roads and automobiles.
Well, I think if you look at the exodus during the nadir of race relations between 1910 and 1940, let's say, to be really narrow about it. I mean, you get 1890, you start having Jim Crow come in, and 1975, schools in the South finally desegregate on a widespread basis. So maybe a little longer than we pretend. You can trace those migration patterns by what were the train lines, what were the bus routes, how did you get out of the South? Because Willie Brown left East Texas because his grandma knew he'd get lynched. And because he was a smart little kid, and that's all you need to be if you're a little black kid, is be a smart kid. Now we've got Ida Hatfield and Will Stafford. Tell us about them, the main couple in your book.
Will's based on actually based on John Singleton Moseby.
Goes without saying.
He's the best that the South has to offer. He's a true gent, you know. He's got a wonderful education. He comes from a wealthy family in Virginia. He's got a law practice of his own. He has a beautiful singing voice.
I remember watching a weekly drama in black and white about John Singleton Moseby. I believe it was called The Gray Ghost.
Yes,
and
it was.
I forget the actor now. I can think of him in a minute, riding along, looking heroic and dashing in his...
He's supposedly the sixth most recognizable figure in the Civil War. But he certainly deserves it, because he was the king of the night, man. They were terrified of Moseby.
Yeah.
Worse than getting killed was getting captured and sent to a prison camp. And the and Moseby roaming the night, you know, and got to pick up your sentries and capture them and take your sutler's wagons and capture your ponies. And people were scared. They just had them shaking in their boots.
Well, I lived within about an hour and a half or so of Andersonville National Cemetery. And at the time, they had not let the trees grow back into the old dead line area. And you had a big... just open area, a little spring down at the end that I forget how many thousand people were supposed to drink out of, no facilities. I ended up reading a lot of the actual reports from Andersonville. And, you know, you can't raise enough to feed yourself. You've got an army in the field, and you've got all these prisoners. And it's just...
Something's got to go.
Yeah, McKinley Canner, I read the book at like 12, I want to say, and it just, you know, my hair curled and never uncurled. You know?
Yes.
It's the ordeal. I mean, of course, Sidney Lanier, the bad poet laureate of Georgia, was on one of the ships, one of the Union prison ships, and caught TB. So, you know, it wasn't like it was a cakewalk anywhere, but certainly in the prisons in the South, you had just wholesale starvation.
They were scraping for resources.
Ooh.
And, well, that's one reason why California's gold loomed so large in the imagination of Jeff Davis.
The first thing you say is California's gold finance union victory.
Yeah.
You know, and there's no... I mean, no question in my mind that you know, but for that, the war could have taken another 10 years because, you know, the South wasn't giving up as long as, you know, they didn't try another on to Richmond maneuver at the...
Yeah. The North could have lost the war. It was hard to see how the South would win it, but the North was certainly capable of losing it.
And that was what was so funny. It was an abolitionist New York newspaper on to Richmond thing, and they got caught at First Manassas and damn near wiped out the army. So,
one of the fascinating things about Will Stafford and Moseby, that connection, is that Moseby was against slavery and he was against secession. And one of the things that really appealed to me in the book was to look at the South a little more closely. I was raised in the deep North.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, there are pieces of Canada that are south of where I was born. And so all the squares had Union soldiers, and, you know, it's really hard for me to read about Chancellorsville and Fredericksburg. You know, those came out all wrong. And it was eye-opening to read about Moseby and just to learn really what a remarkable man he was. And how he actually sort of duked it out with some of the leading secessionists. You know, it wasn't until Virginia actually went out that he made his decision. He was perfectly willing to fight for the Union if Virginia stayed in.
Well, and you had, you know, more than just him and Robert E. Lee, you know, the sainted Robert E. Lee,
right.
You know, saying, look, I swore an oath to the United States. I'm in this. And finally, the CSAS trash, as you might say, got the upper hand and pulled the states out at those conventions. And
you might say that safely in California.
I wouldn't say that at all. Some counties in the north of Georgia, the old Republican counties, I might be able to say it, but they flipped to new Republicans. So
it's hard to keep track, isn't it? Who is Republican?
You. Well, now every statewide elected office holder in Georgia is a Republican now for the first time since Reconstruction.
Yeah, that's as surprising to me as a fan of history as the destruction of the Soviet Union. You know, these are things I never thought to see in my lifetime.
Well, Lyndon Johnson said in 1965 when he signed the Voting Rights Act, we lose the South for a generation, and if you lose something for that long, you may not get it back. And certainly, you know, we'll get around to the dirty little secret of American history, I'm sure, in a few minutes, white supremacy and all that. But And Will Stafford, you know, is really caught in the middle of that. He's a Southerner. He believes, you know, that he has a loyalty to, and Virginia's particularly, they're into that in Virginia, you know.
Well, they had pretty much run the country. I mean, mm-hmm. They were
the mother of presidents.
Yes. Yeah.
Till Ohio took over.
Yeah. I guess they weren't looking, you know, for one election. Whoop, you know, there it went.
That's right. It's all gone. But I think that's the thing is, you know, he's that struggle writ large, or writ in small, writ in the individual.
Will doesn't explain much in the book, in character, but mm-hmm. he does make one little speech where he explains that he owes Virginia double loyalty, and that he sees George Washington, for instance, as the bringer of democracy to both his countries.
That was the most amazing little piece to read.
Yeah.
Well, he was uncomfortably sandwiched between two romantic interests, one of whom's a passionate unionist, and the other of whom is a demonic secessionist. And he's backpedaling as fast as he can go while seated in a chair eating dinner.
you almost... Now, let's talk a little about Ida. Terry, tell us about Ida.
You tell him about Ida. She just growed.
Like, that's right. Where did she come from?
Good question. I know where she ended up is as representing California, as, say, Natasha might represent Russia in War and Peace, mm-hmm. to make an outrageous comparison.
Well, she's there with the flowers at the end, you know, throwing them.
Yes, she's self-centered, mm-hmm. But she's very open to new ideas. You know, mm-hmm. And it dawned on us as we were writing, you know, you don't plot this stuff out, or you know, at least we don't plot it mm-hmm. out in advance. But she is, in some ways, the first American Californian. She's born in Monterey in 1845 when it's still a Mexican province. And that happened because we had to make a plausible story for her mother, Molly, to have surprisingly open views of race. Because if you ask the percentage of white supremacists out of the total of whites in the middle of the 19th century, you're up somewhere around 99.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had to send Molly out to see. She's a white Protestant, and her husband dies, and she is pregnant and destitute in Mexican Monterey. So, you know, bit by bit, she gets the idea that, you know, Catholics aren't going to destroy her soul, that, in fact, they're going to feed her and her baby. And her education continues from there. And Ida is born in Monterey and then goes to the Northern Mines. She and Molly go to the Northern Mines, which is where everybody is, and nobody can keep track of who's who. And the only thing you can bet on is that everybody agrees it's a good idea to get rich in a hurry. You know, but the question is, do you get rich or do I get rich?
That's right. Or do I get rich by selling you things like the Big Four? You know, of course, that's always my favorite little bit of doggerel. Oh, what was your name in the States? Was it Dixon or Johnson or Yates? Did you murder your wife? Did you fly for your life? Oh, what was your name in the States? If you could get rich, you could buy yourself a new history, you know.
Darn right.
Or you get elected president, you could buy yourself a new governor of Texas, you could buy yourself a new history.
Well, we had some pretty colorful governors of California who would have done some serious time in most other communities.
You've got that much money just coursing around. Yes. It's pretty amazing to contemplate.
We also had a frontier ethos about shooting people, and not all that many people are aware that the Chief Justice of the California Supreme Court took exception to some remarks made by our senator, who happened to be a Free Soil Democrat, you know, if you can imagine such a horrible thing, and shot and killed him in a duel.
Mm-hmm.
So California, in this era, was making up its own rules, and they were pretty rough. We led the nation in fatal dueling during the 1850s.
And, you know, there were places where the Irish Code was in use, and you could post somebody. If he wouldn't take the challenge, you could put up a placard that says, so-and-so is a low dog and a coward. He won't fight me.
He's outside the pale of civilized society.
You had to leave town.
Yeah. It was a very serious thing, although today it seems outrageous.
Point of honor, you know. And there's the Molly or Mary. And Will's accomplished, you know, and he says there he's going to go do this. It's a point of honor. He's got to go do it, however foolish it may be, you know.
Well, she knows when she can push males around and when she can't. I like Mary Dunn. Mm-hmm. There's almost nothing to recommend her ethically, but she, in many ways, is my favorite character in the book.
Somehow she seemed the most realistic, you know. She had the most sides to her. You know, everybody's good, but you know... we're not giving you away to say there's not a happy ending. If there was, it would be a comedy, and Ida and Will would ride off into the sunset and live in Pacific Heights until the earthquake, the 1906 earthquake. Right. But no such luck. But I think that's, you know, she's that person that inhabits that nether, that no man's land.
Well, it's no man's land because Mary's in charge of it, and
exactly.
Men don't rate highly with her. They're ornamental, you know. They have wide shoulders, but you know, that's about it as far as she's concerned.
Change tires and supply genetic material. Yeah,
yeah.
similar kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, we sort of keep talking about how California doesn't go secessionist, and yet it almost comes down to one person's conscience.
Yes. And that one person in our case was a man who later turned out to be a Confederate general. The most likely scenario for California when the Great Division happened, mm-hmm. you know, the spring of 61, when people are really figuring out, you know, where they stand, the most likely direction was for horrible bloodshed, because mm-hmm. demographically we were a border state.
Oh, yeah.
And the other place that sort of lines up the way we do is Missouri. Where and that turned out to be very unfortunate. Just a terrible story, because the fighting there was outside the control of the army structures on both
exactly.
sides. And it was sort of like Serbia or Iraq or someplace. It's just...
Well, Jesse James.
Hideous, yeah. And it echoes for decades afterwards.
Yeah.
They didn't tame easily.
Mm.
And at the beginning of the war, California was, specifically the Presidio in San Francisco, mm-hmm. was the head of the U.S. Army Department of the Pacific.
Mm-hmm.
And it had just received a new commander called Albert Sidney Johnston, who was one of America's outstanding soldiers. He'd been, you know, in a lot of places and done a lot of remarkable things. And in the heated political climate of the time, most people, pro-Northern and pro-Southern, assumed that he'd been placed there by the horrible, treasonous Buchanan administration to feed California to the Confederacy. And, you know, nobody told Sidney Johnston about this when he was appointed.
Yeah. I remember Judge Albert Tuttle was head of the IRS, and Eisenhower in 54 said, "I'm going to put you on the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals." And he said, "Oh, great, I can go down south and retire into a federal appeals judgeship, and life will be cool, and here comes the civil rights movement."
So, wham!
Yes,
these things happen.
That's just what happened to Sidney Johnston. Yeah. He wanted to go down to L.A. and retire. He was relieved mm-hmm. of his command. Well, I guess I'm not telling the whole story. Right.
I was going to say,
leaving out Asbury Harford.
Okay,
I don't want to leave him out.
No, well, and that's really part of what we're here, because, you know, you look in your, as you said, you look in your school book, and there's California, a blue state with the other blue states, and not, you know.
It has to be just like New York, because it voted for Lincoln. What people don't realize is that Lincoln won by 700 votes. And you get different counts, you know,
sure.
It's in that range. And it was less than a third of the total.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a four-way race, mm-hmm. and you can win with 32% of the vote.
Exactly.
And you're splitting the vote with Stephen Douglas, Northern mm-hmm. Democrat, and John Breckinridge, who is the former vice president of the United States, and is soon to become probably one of the better political generals of the war
mm-hmm.
For the South. So you can assume that about a third of Californians were pro-Southern, not necessarily willing to pick up a gun, but in favor of the South succeeding in its efforts to become a nation.
Mm-hmm.
But for Sidney Johnston, all this came as a bit of a surprise. You know, he's assigned to this new post, and then all of a sudden people are approaching him saying, "How about handing over the arsenal and the defenses of San Francisco?"
Perhaps it was Edmund Randolph who first approached Sidney Johnston. We don't know for sure. He was one of the scion of those famous Southern families. And perhaps other members of the Knights of the Golden Circle
right.
came to Sidney Johnston and said, "How about it?
Want to hand it over?
Want to hand it over? We know you know about your loyalty to Texas. Texas is going out. Where do you stand?" And he said that he was going to defend the property of the United States with the last drop of blood in his body, and he was not going to betray his officer's oath. Because how could his people trust him if he were not to discharge his duties, you know? And so he resigned his commission. They sent Sumner out to replace him.
Mm-hmm.
He went down to Los Angeles and tried to live in retirement. But like you said, the circumstances overtook him, and the clamor for him to give for his sword to support the cause of the South was just too great. And so he joined up with the secessionist Mounted Rifles, the Los Angeles
Los Angeles Mounted Rifles, the only militia in any free state to actually go fight for the South. And what makes it truly interesting is that they rode across the entire Southwest in the middle of summer to do it. Right? 800 – these guys are enthusiasts.
You know?
They're 800 miles. And along the way, they got to visit with the Chiricahua Apaches, who were
– burning stagecoaches.
Yeah.
Yeah, the meanest Indians maybe in the world.
Well, the angriest.
Yeah, yeah, angriest, certainly.
They were ready to do in some white people if they got held on.
And he gets back and he gets commissioned and he walks right into...
The poor man is appointed head of the Western Theater for the Confederacy. He's the head of what they call the Army of Tennessee. And he comes closer than any Confederate general to dumping Grant into the river. The first day at Shiloh was a Southern victory, and it was pretty miraculous that the Union held. Grant was reinforced, and he drove Johnston back. But Johnston wasn't there to see the second day. He caught a bullet in the leg. And true to his chivalric form, he had just sent his personal physician to go care for some Union wounded. And he bled to death when a simple tourniquet would have saved his life.
Oh, yeah. No.
So he's worshipped there. And if you have a cult of chivalry, you could do worse than starting with Johnston, because he was the real thing.
He stood up for it. That's what's so amazing. I mean, if you've ever read What I Saw at Shiloh by Ambrose Bierce, you get, you know, what really happened at Shiloh versus what you were told happened at Shiloh.
There's also a really good book by Shelby Foote, just called Shiloh, that's probably, for my money, the best description of the Civil War combat experience.
Oh, I was just going to say that many people came to Sidney Johnston for advice. They, what shall I do? You know, my heart is with the South. What do I do? He says, go back east and fight, and don't fight here if you want to be involved. He says, it would be too horrible here in California. It's be neighbor against neighbor, and no one could imagine the horrors that would happen.
Well, apart from the Presidio in Monterey and a few other places, you didn't have any significant conurbations. You just had little settlements, and you had places like the Gold Country, where we come back to, where people just lived because that's where they could get fed.
Yes.
Well, they started raising militias right away, in state-authorized militia. In fact, there were militia units authorized before that in order to settle the hash of the Indians.
Yes,
exactly.
And it's quite an interesting story, the way the regulars were replaced by the state militia and the unhappy effect it had on the Indian population.
Now, while we're talking about the Indian population, I know, Terry, that you have been involved in some Maidu studies lately.
Well, when we first started this novel, I knew I wanted to write about the Maidu, and I wanted to have a character in the book. So I started looking around for help, and I found the Maidu language and culture classes had just started up in Nevada City, the Chayakam Maidu up there, extending, you know, themselves into the community for healing and understanding. And they started up these wonderful classes in the language. So I was enrolled, I think it's been about 3.5 years now. And so I'm learning and putting everything I'm learning into the character in the book.
I wanted to be sure that we mentioned to our listeners, there's a movie this Sunday, and then an event in about 3 weeks.
Yeah, Indigenous Peoples Day, you know, the old Columbus Day.
Exactly. We got it. Columbus
right
Day, we got it.
October 7th to 10th this year. And Indigenous people up there in Nevada City have, I think this may be their 14th year with the celebration, calling back the salmon and some other great stuff. So they're having a Maidu movie night this coming Sunday at St. Joseph's Hall up there in Grass Valley.
Right.
They're going to show three movies. One is a documentary about John Trudell, who's going to be there. He's one of the main figures of the American Indian movement. Mm-hmm. He was on Alcatraz and was really one of their voices. Another new film called Ishi that has just been put out by a young Native American woman from Oroville, and another film called Uma Totodom that's a documentary about the Chayakam people
themselves.
Nevada City Maidu, yeah.
I'm looking here and seeing Ann Halo is here for the 6 to 8 o'clock show, and we're going to have to clear out in a second here and make way for them. But if you want to learn some more about this, if you want to get signed copies from the authors, if you want to get further into this, you can go to BearRiverBooks.com.
That's it.
And there's a link on the show page today at KDVS.org for Speaking in Tongues. We're going to have to get out of here and make way for Ann Halo, but we want to thank you. TJ and Richard for joining us. We want to thank you, our listeners, for tuning in today, and we will see you again soon.